You like to, I actually don't find a Bible. You can find a Bible. You can look it up in Luke 15, but I'm going to read it to you in the message this morning, and we're going to talk together a little message about Luke 15 as we describe why Joe and Bob and Rob are getting in that pool today. We're going to be talking about the gospel. We're going to be talking about good news. We're going to be talking about grace, and this is the best story all about that, really. Luke 15 is all about that idea of grace. So I'll read this to you. Hang on, I'll just close that door. Simon has to come back through it, poor devil. Yeah, there you go. Okay. But this is in the Message, so I thought I'd read it to you in a very modern version, Message translation. Very famous story. Then Jesus said, "There was once a man who had two sons. The younger said to his father, 'Father, I want now what is coming to me.'" That sounds like an invitation to trouble, in my opinion. But that's what he said, and we know what he meant. So the father divided the property between them. It wasn't long before the younger son packed his bags and left for a distant country. And there, undisciplined and dissipated, he wasted everything that he had. After he'd gone through all his money, there was a bad famine all through that country, and he began to hurt. He signed on with a citizen who assigned him to his fields to slop the pigs. He was so hungry, he would have eaten the corn cobs in the pig slop, but no one would give him any. And that brought him to his senses. He said, "All those farmhands working for my father sit down to eat three meals a day, and here I am starving to death. I'm going back to my father." It's a key phrase, isn't it? I'm going to go back to my father. "And I'll say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against God, and I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son. So take me as a hired hand.' He got right up and he went to his father. And when he was still a long way off, his father saw him, his heart pounding. He ran out, embraced him, and kissed him. The son started his speech. 'Father, I have sinned against God. I have sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son ever again.' But the father wasn't listening. He was calling to the servants, 'Quick, bring a clean set of clothes and dress him. Put the family ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Then get the grain-fed heifer and roast it. We are going to feast. We're going to have a wonderful time. My son is here, given up for dead, but now alive. Given up for lost, but now he's found.' And they began to celebrate." It's a great version of a very familiar story that many of you know. And I thought we'd talk about that this morning. I thought we'd talk about grace, because that's the heart of what we believe as Christians. It is about grace. A lot of people think Christians are very judgmental. Some of them are. Let's be honest. Some of them are really judgmental. But you know what? God is a God of grace, a God of infinite grace. And we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about amazing grace. I think it's on the screen in a minute. Let me tell you a little story. It's an old story. I went to a college called Spurgeon's. I'm still going there one day a week at the moment for a bit of training. And Spurgeon lived at a time in the 19th century when there were some big preachers around other than him. And one of them was called Joseph Parker. They both had huge churches. They attracted thousands, tens of thousands sometimes, came to listen to these guys as they spoke about Jesus. And on one occasion, Parker commented on the poor condition of children admitted to Spurgeon's orphanage. Now, he's talking about the condition of the children, but it got reported to Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the great preacher, that he had criticized his orphanages, not the condition of the children going into them. And Spurgeon blasted Parker from the pulpit the next Sunday. The attack was printed, because every one of his sermons was printed and publicized, was printed in the paper the next day, the national paper, and became the talk of the town. And of course, people then, the next Sunday, they flocked to Parker's church because they wanted to know, what's he going to say about this then? They just wanted the gossip. And he was packed. Parker's church was more packed than usual. Here's what he said. I understand Dr. Spurgeon is not in his pulpit today, and this is the Sunday they usually take an offering for the orphanage. I suggest we take a love offering here instead. That's how he responded. And the crowd were delighted. They were so delighted they had to pass the bag around three times. Literally, they passed it around three times. So much was raised. Later that week, there was a knock on the door on Parker's study. It was Charles Haddon Spurgeon. He said this, "You know, Parker, you have practiced grace on me. You have given me not what I deserved, but what I needed." On that day, Spurgeon experienced this thing called grace. And it's when you get not what you deserve, but it's what you get. It's when you get what you need, not what you deserve. And on that day, when the prodigal son crested a hill, looking at his father's house, expecting payback, expecting never ever to be even called that father's son again, never to be accepted back in the family, he experienced grace too. He expected not what he deserved, but what he desperately needed. It's a radical departure, isn't it, from how we live today and how people live. We live in a culture where you only get a break if you earn it. You have to earn stuff to get it. It's the hardworking employee who gets the promotion. It's the conscientious student who gets the extension on their essay, isn't it? It's the well-behaved child who gets the ice cream at the end of the afternoon, isn't it? We grow up being conditioned. Literally conditioned. If you want something, you have to earn it and you have to deserve it. That's how we are brought up. That's how I was brought up. Now, based on that understanding, most people think they'll earn a break from God if they deserve it and if they do enough to deserve it. So if they're being good and kind and all the rest of it. After all, if this technique is paying off in the rest of my life, why wouldn't it pay off with God? If that, and it does pay off in the rest of your life, doesn't it? That's how we behave with each other. So it should work with God, shouldn't it? But it doesn't take genius to work out there are a few problems with the whole system of deserving and earning. What's the quota of good deeds that will be enough? Where's the line? What's the number? Where's the pass mark? What happens if I blow it? What happens if I blow it? And I think that system feels a little bit like snakes and ladders, doesn't it? Feels a little bit like that. You might, if I do something wrong, will I lose some ground? How much ground will I lose? Is it a big snake? Am I down at square one again? Or is it a small stake? Am I just, you know, I can pick this ground up again? The whole system of do I deserve it? Have I done enough? Makes you feel like snakes and ladders. And whenever you mess up, you don't know where you're going to end up. The biggest problem, of course, is what God says about all of our good behavior. And this is a bit of a shocker, especially if you think you're a good person. Listen to this. We're all imperfect and impure with sin. And when we proudly display our righteous deeds, they are but filthy rags. That's not good news if you think God is impressed with good deeds and proper behavior and earning your way in and deserving it. Should become obvious, you'll never be good enough. We'll never make the grade. We'll never get into heaven on our own ticket. There is no performance scheme. No performance-related incentive scheme in heaven. There may be in your job. There may have been in your family. There may be in your relationships. And that's how the world works. But it doesn't exist in heaven. That doesn't operate there. There isn't one. Now, it might seem a bit odd, but the moment you realize that, let me tell you something. The moment you realize God doesn't work like this is the best day of your life. Because that's the day you realize you need to catch a different train, one called grace. And if you want proof, the Bible confirms it beyond any doubt. This is what Ephesians 2 says. For it is by grace you've been saved, through faith, through trust, just trust. This is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God. It's not by works, it's not your good deeds or your behavior, it's not by any of those things, so that none of you can boast. That's what the prodigal son found out, that's what the story is all about. And that's what we need to realize. God is a God who longs to be gracious to people. Psalm 103 verse 8 says this. The Lord is merciful and gracious. He is slow to anger and he is abounding in love. You may have grown up with a different picture. Let me tell you, that's not the Bible picture. It's just not there. We fail to realize just how gracious he is in terms of grace. He is on another planet from you and me. He is so different from me and from you. Let me give you an example, a practical example of what, how God treats us and how we operate. Here's what you need to know. Let's say you're out, it's Godston, it's Surrey, so you're out trimming your hedge on a Sunday morning, okay? You're out trimming the hedge after the service. When you notice the 15-year-old kid who lives down your street, who doesn't have a driving license, suddenly jumps into his father's car. And he starts reversing out of his drive in the way that a 15-year-old without a driving license would. Erratic, to say the least. So he's ploughing out onto the road, and with a squeal of tyres, he swerves all over the road, miraculously missing everything, absolutely everything, except your prize hedge and your car, which he ploughs into with great abandon. Now you have three choices. What do? You only really have three choices. The first thing you can do is you can treat him with this. Justice. Oh, justice. You can give him what he deserves. That's what justice is, giving someone what they deserve. All right, Schumacher, you say as you stare at him and dragging him out from the driver's seat. You messed up. I'm going to call the police. And then they're going to charge you for driving without a license. Then I'm going to call your parents and I'm going to tell them just what happened. And then you're going to spend between now and Christmas trying to pay off some of the damage that you've done. That is the deal. Now listen, if you treated that situation like that, would that make you a bad person? No. That's called justice, isn't it? That's right and proper. You're giving him what he deserves. You're giving him what he deserves. No more and no less. It's not revenge. It's justice. However, you do have another option. And the second thing you could do is you could treat him with this word, with mercy. Now, mercy is giving someone a little less than they actually deserve. It's pulling the punch in a way. Okay, sunshine, I'm not going to call the police, but I am going to talk to your parents and we're going to find out how much it costs to repair my prize hedge, because you're not worried about the car. The hedge is the most important thing, let's be honest. Now, if you do that, the kid might be very grateful to you. Because instead of applying strict justice, now you've chosen to be merciful. You've given him less than he deserves. But there is one other option. Justice, mercy, slightly less than you deserve, or what you deserve. But there is another option. And the third option is you could treat that 15-year-old Formula One driver with grace. Let me tell you what that looks like. And you're going to struggle with this. Because imagine this is you. Imagine this is your hedge. Maybe a hedge isn't working for you. Think of something else. But, I don't know, anything, you know. The car. Yeah, go for the car. Okay. imagine if you respond like this. Okay, Sonny Jim, you messed up. You messed up. You dented my car and you murdered my hedge. A thing of beauty. A thing I've been working on for years. But I'm not going to call the police. I'm not going to call your family. I reckon I can fix the damage. So how about this? How about you and I get in the car? We're going to drive down to McDonald's. We're going to order a budget meal, because I'm gracious, but I'm not that good. And while we do that, you can tell me about yourself. You can tell me what prompted you to get in that car in the first place. You can tell me what your hopes and dreams are. You can let's get to know each other a little bit, and I want to hear from you. There's just one condition, by the way. What's that, says the 15-year-old? Well, I'm driving. That's the only condition. What's your reaction to that? To that choice? That is the stupidest thing you've ever heard of, isn't it? That kid is going to go right out and do exactly the same thing again. He's going to murder hedges all over Surrey. You know what? He might. He might. That's a risk. And that's the risk that that word always takes with anybody it deals with. The risk that they might just carry on doing it. But it's also possible, and this is also true, and this is why we've got a baptism today, and this is why people become Christians and their lives change. It's also possible that this scandalous offer of grace could touch something very deep within that 15-year-old kid. And that the obvious care you have for him, rather than a feeling of deep revenge, the obvious care and compassion for him you have for him might actually change his heart and his mind and even his life. You could make a big impact on that kid. You might still be scandalized by this, so let me put it another way. Let's ask not what this kid deserves from us, justice or mercy or grace. Grace, one of those three. Let's ask what we deserve from God. What do we deserve from God? Because we understand that we've actually blown things in terms of God. We haven't murdered his hedge. We're doing a good job of murdering his planet at the moment. Something he spent quite a bit of time and effort and energy and power and wisdom and glory putting together. But we're murdering that. And we're damaging each other. So we're not just hitting the hedge, we're hitting each other. We're making a bit of a mess of the world. And Romans 6:23 says, the wages of sin is death. God says that the day we rebel against him, the day we shake our fist at God and say, listen, I know you're wise, I know you want the best for me and all the rest of it, but I'm not doing it your way, I'm doing it my way. The day you disobey him and start living recklessly, a bit like that son who says, give me what I want and I'm going to do exactly what I want with it. To hang the consequences, it's my life. Not yours, God, mine. The minute we do that, it says the wages of sin is death. It doesn't mean that we die or drop dead at the moment. It means stuff in our lives dies. Relationships start dying. As we act recklessly and thoughtlessly and without compassion and love and self-sacrifice towards other people. Our finances probably die as we get into debt and behave stupidly with them. Things in our life start to die quite quickly when we do things without God. In a moral economy ruled by a perfect holy God, we commit cosmic treason every time we say, God, my way, not your way. You know why? Because if God really is God, and if he really did make us, then he deserves our loyalty and our love and our focus. He deserves that, and he hasn't got it. And we're his. The Bible says, you are not your own. You belong to this God who made you. He has rights in the same way that an artist owns the painting. In the same way that a potter owns the pot. God owns me because I am his. He made me. He chose to create me. I am his possession, whether I acknowledge it or not. Now, if we were to get option one from God, We would get straight justice. We would be obliterated on the spot. And God would be with it, wouldn't be being mean. God wouldn't be being nasty. He has the right to do with his possessions, with his creations, exactly what he wants, because they're his. I wouldn't criticize an artist for binning some art that they created because they didn't think it was good enough anymore. I wouldn't say they couldn't do that because it's theirs. And God is the same. He would be right to do it. He wouldn't be being nasty or cruel or harsh or unreasonable. He would just be applying justice, giving us what we deserved. What if we were to receive mercy? Psalm 103, verse 10 says this: He does not punish us for our sins. He does not deal harshly with us as we deserve. So we do get mercy. The Bible seems to say God operates with that word mercy sometimes, because God is merciful. His policy is not one strike and you're out. There is not a one-to-one relationship between our sinning and our dying on the spot. For some reason, God lets us get away with stuff. And you know that. People have got away with stuff, and you've got away with stuff. Apparently without cost. It's the reason we're all sitting here today, I suspect. It's the reason why I'm drawing breath and talking to you. His amazing mercy is what keeps us alive right now. What gives us life. There was an atheist, a famous atheist, who said, if there is a God, let him prove himself by striking me dead right now. Nothing happened. To which the Christian replied, no, you haven't proved there is no God. You've just proved that he's very merciful. Which is true. But then comes grace. What if God dealt with us not on the basis of justice, not on the basis of mercy, giving us a little bit less than we actually deserve, being a bit lenient. But what if God dealt with us with grace? Grace is outrageously blessing other people, bestowing freely on an undeserving person something they don't deserve. What if God dealt with us like that? It's scandalous, it's too good to be true, and it could never happen. It doesn't generally happen in the real world. People don't behave like that. They don't behave like that to the 15-year-old with the Schumacher syndrome. They don't. Yet the Bible says it does happen. It has happened. God says, I'm going to do something that defies all logic. This is the Bible. This is what's out of the Bible. And when they realize, he says, when they realize what I've done for them, there is going to be this massive explosion in their hearts. They're going to be so blown away by my reaction to them. It will change them forever. That is God's plan and strategy. And that's what happened to the prodigal son. When you know what you deserve, but you get something wonderful, more wonderful than you could ever imagine or have hoped for, something happens inside of you. Something explodes. And as he crested that rise, as he expected to receive justice, I don't deserve to be called your son. As he expected and hoped for mercy, because he knew Dad and he knew he was a good man. But maybe I can be a hired hand. I won't get exactly what I deserve, but I'll get something. As he stood in that pig pen and dared to imagine his father's mercy, never in his wildest dreams did he imagine what was waiting for him down that road. The delinquent son got grace, not justice or mercy, grace. Totally out of line with what he deserved. I can imagine there was an explosion in his heart in that moment. You know what? And I bet that son was never the same again. That reckless young guy who went away and disrespected his dad and all he'd saved up to give him an inheritance and a future and a plan and security, and he'd blown it all. Just trodden on Dad's passion for him. And when he saw how Dad reacted to that with grace, his heart just exploded. He was never the same. Can you imagine him going out a month later and doing exactly the same thing? I can't. I don't think he would. After having that response from his dad. His heart was blown apart by grace. That son, that old son was dead, and a new son was alive. And until that explosion happens in your heart, you'll never really understand God. You'll never really understand the gospel, the good news that is called the Bible. You'll never really understand its power. And you'll never really understand its cost. The cost of that word grace to God. Because God didn't just wink at our sin. You know what? The truth is, God is a God of justice. So he can't behave as if wrong doesn't matter. I can't worship a God who sees evil and says, oh, that's okay. I wouldn't want to worship him. I don't think he's a good God if he ignores evil, if he ignores sin. But that includes even the stuff I do. When I hurt someone, or I say something a bit cutting, or I lie or cheat. He's got to take note of that as well, if he's a good and a just God. God didn't just wink at my sin. Jesus, his son, paid for it all. So justice was done, except it was done on him. Not on me. Jesus died on a cross, and that cross was a transaction that did the justice, that dealt with the need for justice. But because of that transaction, 2,000 years ago, God now can offer you and me grace. He offers us the third option. Because of that, he offers us grace. All you have to do, I suppose, is what that prodigal son did. All you have to do is what Bob and Joe and Rob are witnessing that they've done. First thing you do is you wake up and you realize you've blown it. There is something to admit here. There is something to admit that living without God and living my way, not his way, has hurt me and has hurt others, and I'm not proud of that. There's something to admit. And there's also something to do. There's something to do, which is to go back to the Father. To stop living in the pig pen. To walk back to him. Trusting. Not that he's going to meet out the justice. That's done. Trusting even not that you won't, that you'll just get mercy. That's not enough. But that you will be scandalized by the grace of God. And when you find him, when you go home to him, something happens in here. It blows your world apart. It changes you. And the third thing to do is just accept. Accept that what Jesus did on that cross is what enables you to receive the grace. Because of the justice that was paid there, you get the grace. It's to accept what he's done and to live in awe of it for the rest of your life. And then to start living as if you could treat other people the same way God has treated you. Not with justice, not even with mercy, but scandalously with grace. Could you do that? Could you change another person's life yourself as you begin to respond to them how God responds to you? That is what this is all about. That is why we're baptizing three people today. It is all about Jesus. It is all about grace. It is